This month's podcast sponsor is StormForge. StormForge's Kubernetes performance testing and optimization platform is the easiest way to ensure your applications behave the way you want them to, while cutting out unnecessary resources and time spent manually tuning. In alignment with this, StormForge is asking for your help reducing the amount of unused cloud resources, making both a financial and environmental impact in the world today. We want you to help make that impact with us. So visit https://stormforge.io/podcast. That's stormforge.io/podcast. To learn more about how you can help erase cloud waste and take the cloud waste pledge. While you're there, try out the free tier, the machine learning backed service, to start saving resources and getting better performance today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. Today, I got Jimmy Zielinski. He is one of the founders of Petricorp.io. Fantastic dude. I mean, everybody I've talked to from the CoreOS side is always like, Jimmy, you got to talk to Jimmy, right? So, Jimmy, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So, you grew up in Philadelphia, the suburbs of Philadelphia. Talk to me about like your humble beginnings. Talk about your, you know, first time you started computing, all that fun stuff.
Yeah, sure. I guess it's not super humble. I basically am just like a complete computer nerd. I grew up just always spending time on the computer. I played lots of video games on the computer. Eventually started hosting.
What games like, did you play on the computer? Let's talk about that.
Like MMOs, literally going back to the earliest days. It was like starts with like Habbo Hotel and shit like that. Like really old, like precursors to MMOs. And like then console games mostly. But what actually happened to me was I started like hosting like Counter-Strike servers and things like that and game forums. And that kind of like showed me the world of IRC and like Linux. And basically from like 13 through maybe like 19, I actually like, I guess it's my first job technically, hosted services. It was like a sysadmin. It's actually kind of crazy. Because like people playing games would be vicious. They'd try to hack each other's forums. They would like distributed denial of service each other. Like literally at the same time, there's like news going on about like Anonymous and all these people like DDoSing, like literally in the Middle East as like vigilante justice. Crazy shit was happening where I'm like, these like 14-year-old kids are DDoSing with like way more bandwidth on my like tiny little Linux servers on like Linode. I'm like, what the actual hell is happening in the world that like there's giant press on like these crazy huge attacks. Meanwhile, my tiny little internet forums are getting completely destroyed by like 10 times as much. And like, honestly, that experience drove me to be super clever. Like you learn a lot of internal details, like crazy lower level details of networking and Linux, and like really forced me to kind of get out of my comfort zone pretty early. I basically used like a Pentium 4 till like 2012. So I had a super fucking slow computer. Couldn't even run the latest Windows. So then I ran like Arch Linux and now I use a Mac. But yeah, really weird beginnings, just like forcing myself to always be clever. It wasn't until college till I started programming though. So it was purely sysadmin work.
But again, I think, you know, being that DIY kind of gaming, you know, it's the same. I have a similar kind of with what I do, like, you know, I started doing a lot of like Usenet stuff and all that fun stuff and, you know, like BitTorrent and stuff. So you actually wrote a standards draft for like BitTorrent. That's and a tracker that's used for orchestration. So talk to me about that.
Sure. Yeah. So, basically what happened was, like I said, I never started programming until college. There's this kind of meme that goes around when you're younger that, like if you learn programming on your own, you'll pick up bad habits and then you'll be forced to unlearn them. That is entirely false. Yet that like mind virus basically stopped me from learning how to program like almost entirely up until I got to college and I started taking courses in it. I took courses that were like C++ and then Java eventually. And I remember just getting to the course where I learned about threading. And I was like, there's no fucking way that this is how people actually program. like parallelism. Like the future is going to be tons of cores on computers. That's the only way they're going to get faster. So like, how the hell is this shitty thread pool API like the thing that people are actually going to use? So I was super upset with like parallelism in Java. And that was at the point I started like looking at other languages. I looked at like Erlang and then eventually Go. And so this is kind of where it all started in the Go ecosystem for me. It's around like 2010. So around like 2010, I start playing with Go. One of the projects I wanted to work on was BitTorrent Tracker, which is the thing that lets you find other peers in BitTorrent. And then once you connect to them directly, that's when you actually share the content. So it's kind of like a router for BitTorrent. I just decided BitTorrent was cool. I was a kid in like college, so I was like trying to get everything for free, right? So you're kind of scrappier then. So BitTorrent software seemed like really cool. And just started working on that. And basically what happened was I noticed like some parts of the protocol that were widely adopted were not actually written anywhere. So it's kind of one of those things where somebody wrote the original spec and then a couple reference implementations kind of tried to make everybody compatible with each other, but then nobody ever like came full circle and wrote that back into the spec. Sort of standards draft for a thing. Part of like the UDP protocol, just to get that actually written and codified, even though literally everyone already implemented it. So that's really cool to be in like the credits for something so popular. But yeah, like peer-to-peer and distributed systems were super interesting thing for me at the time. And what eventually happened was like one day, maybe it was like junior year, I ran an IRC channel for the project. A bunch of different people contributed to it. Basically like someone, an SRE from Facebook hits me up and is like, hey, like we want to use this. Or like, actually, I think I'm pretty sure they told me, hey, we're already using this. So I had like an interesting discussion. Basically, there's an orchestration system at Facebook called Tupperware, and Tupperware is the thing that actually schedules software. It's basically their Kubernetes, predates Kubernetes. It's actually pretty janky. It's effectively like a weird mixture between container orchestration and configuration management, because it's actually just kind of like a bunch of scripts that move like RPMs onto different machines. So it's kind of like a weird cross between Chef and Kubernetes. But one of the interesting things is that it distributes those RPMs via BitTorrent, which is super cool.
And, wow. So let's talk about that. That's so much efficiency to that. Like, you know, that's pretty ingenious. Like taking, again, that scrappy, if you think about you as an admin, it's like, what can I do to keep my channels up and again, DDoSed? I mean, I did something simple like the IP set stuff, like being able to like block. I was getting hacked constantly from all types of Russian and Chinese like IP. So I just, you know, blocked the subnets. Like you got to get scrappy if you're doing that, because you're not going to go buy, you know, an IDS IPS system. And then that's funny that Facebook was just like, hey, I'm seeing this guy doing a ton of stuff, writing a standards doc for open source. And then there's a tracker called Chiaia, right? And so being able to like use that, that's again, it's so again, being able to contribute to these enterprise level companies with this open source, like scrappy roots, that seems like your story, Jimmy. You know what I mean? Like having that like piece there.
Like, I really think it's a scenario of like, if you build it, they will come. Like if it's enough, there's a reason for you to build it. You look around and like no one is doing something and you need to solve the problem, like solve it. People will also need it as well. Like if you see the problem, you solve it as well. The interesting thing like with Chiaia actually is that you get these crazy efficiencies out of using BitTorrent, and like you see Alibaba actually doing quite similar with pouch containers nowadays, like many years later. Or I think it's Dragonfly. Yeah, Dragonfly is like the actual framework, but pouch containers are like the thing they distribute. But actually, the thing I'm super impressed with Facebook is generally their network. They could do lots of optimizations so that they could assume basically, they can look at an IP address of an individual machine. And because they've actually planned out their whole network, they can actually look at the IP address, look at what subnet it's in, and say, this is in the same rack as me. And then they don't like send any data over the backbone across data centers. They can totally optimize. So a lot of the stuff you could do in Chiaia that you couldn't do with any other BitTorrent software was actually encapsulate that knowledge. So Chiaia would actually prefer traffic that was local to them. So they would keep most of their traffic in rack. And honestly, we still are nowhere near that level. It was kind of jarring for me when I started working at CoreOS, because you start working with enterprise customers and you realize their networks are clusterfuck of just random things glued together. You acquire somebody, now you have overlapping subnets, like no one has a cohesive network. And yet Facebook has a completely planned cohesive network. Everything is IPv6, and there's only a couple things that do IPv4, and they're dual stack. So they have both stacks. And it's just like the hyperscalers work on another completely new level, right? That's not your average mom and pop show, or even
because they initiated, because they've initially from that start, they architected in such a way that they were built in that way. Right. And so, yeah, it's, you know, it's economy scales. And then, you know, when you hear, oh yeah, we're just going to dump a service mesh in here and all my networks going to be all right. Well, it's not going to work. And no offense to you, service mesh people. I love you. You know, I do, but it's just the reality is that underlying kind of foundation, if that's somewhat flawed, no matter what happens, you know, you're not going to have the, you know, the Google level scale, you're not going to have the Facebook level scale, you know, whatever it might be. So let's shift gears a little bit before we get into CoreOS. I want to talk, because I think this is a natural segue. I mean, you also worked on like OCI, I think, was that in the later stages of CoreOS? I'm just curious about that.
So that was in the later stages of CoreOS. Okay. It wasn't necessarily at the beginning. Okay. But yeah, standards bodies are kind of like a thing for me, I guess, at this point, having done BitTorrent and now OCI.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. So let's talk again. CoreOS is, you know, it's very, very near and dear to my heart. I have a couple of friends that are from there, and I've met you through a couple of my friends that have worked there and stuff like that, Jimmy. And talk to me about, it's a special place. Everybody I talk to, and you know, and I want you to probably relay me a Redbeard story, but let's go ahead and, you know, tell me like your, hey, I just interviewed with, you know, Brandon and Alex, and talk to me about that.
Yeah. So it's actually like a pretty interesting story, because I'm in New York. I've always worked in New York. And like CoreOS has been San Francisco. So how the hell did I get a job? So that's like the initial question. Basically what happened was, I graduated school. I moved to New York. I knew I wanted to be in New York. I have family here. My sister moved here after college. So, I basically lived in Brooklyn the whole time, and I was more, didn't want to move to the West Coast, cause I want to be close to my family. They're in Philly. I can always hop on the train and go home. And so like kind of West Coast was off limits in my head. I'm not going to San Francisco. Really like New York, and I was convinced I could find a tech company out here. What happened was CoreOS basically acquired Quay, which Jake and Joey, my co-founders for my new company, because I've been working with them this whole time. And that kind of opened up a New York office. And I just saw like a Hacker News post that was like, hey, we're hiring in New York. And I knew CoreOS because I had worked on Go really early. And Doozer was this this project that was like the testament to Go at the time. It was the first Paxos implementation in Go, which is basically, it's the spiritual predecessor to etcd. Basically what happened was people at Heroku did this, and everyone kind of like rang the bell to be like, Go is a real programming language, you can implement Paxos. And then Blake Mizrani actually started working on etcd at CoreOS with Chiang. Basically etcd became the successor and used Raft instead of Paxos. So I knew etcd and I knew CoreOS through that, and was like, holy shit, I worked on peer-to-peer systems, distributed systems, it's all in Go. Like CoreOS is like the fit for me. I was actually interviewing at Google at the time and just like bailed halfway through the Google interview. I also interviewed at Datadog at the same time. And it was kind of like this choice between them, and I ended up bailing and then going to CoreOS because I thought that was more fun. But yeah, my interviews were in person with Pulvi. So Pulvi had just happened to be in New York at the time. And honestly, the way I got the job was just a cold email to Pulvi. Like I saw the post on Hacker News, shot Pulvi an email, was like, hey, I work on peer-to-peer like BitTorrent stuff in Go. It'd be really cool. Like Facebook uses BitTorrent to move around their containers. Why don't you? And that was kind of the pitch, and that kind of sold them. The interview was really interesting. They made me like describe a DHT, like how DHTs work, distributed hash tables. And now like after the fact, I thought like Pulley was really grilling me. But then after the fact, I talked to him later and he's like, yeah, I had no idea how they work. Genuinely, I just wanted to learn from you how they worked. So it's a super cool experience. And like immediately came out the gates working on Quay. And at the time, Quay was, I don't even think Docker had their private registry out yet at that point.
So can we take a step back? So let's explain to folks, you know, again, there's a lot of folks that know what Quay is, but for the uninitiated, what is Quay?
So Quay is a Docker registry. And what a Docker registry does is store your images in a centralized place. Think of it like GitHub, but for Docker images, container images. So at the time, Docker had their own, but it was basically just public images that were there. They didn't really have anything private. So the thing that Quay did initially was actually allow you to have private images, private repositories. And Jake and Joey actually had initially built it as like a periphery service. They were building a cloud IDE and they just needed to have private containers. They were using containers to actually like secure and like let people execute code on their servers as part of their IDE. And they needed something private, so they assumed other people would pay for it. And they did. Basically, they ended up dropping their IDE product just to go running with Quay because so many more people cared about Quay. I started working on that with them. I'm trying to remember the train of thought. Quay was like the major project, and eventually.
Can we talk a little bit about like just Joey and you know,
and Jake. Partner?
Yeah, and Jake. I want to talk about that because I've met them. And they're just like Joey, I've spent some time with like in San Diego a little bit, and man, that guy, both all of you are just brilliant dudes. And like, you think of things so out of the box, and it just seems like you naturally gravitated towards each other, just in terms of like what's that cohesion like you have, like where one ends and the other one picks up? Because that's, I think, the best part of partnership is like, you know, like naturally fitting those, like, you know, the talents together. Like, how would you say, like, how do you work well with them?
I think it's actually a really great experience having like the three of us. Basically what happened was Jake and Joey met at Google working on the APIs team there. So Joey is actually the creator of Source Maps, the thing that maps like JavaScript, basically the compiled JavaScript to the language you're compiling to. So if you're using like TypeScript or CoffeeScript, the way your browser can actually tell you like where you messed up in your code in the source language and not in the compiled JavaScript. Joey invented that while he was there. He worked on Protobuf while he was there as well with Kenton.
I owe my career to him. I'm like, in terms of Sysdig uses Protobufs, right? And so like, you know, Joey's like I said, I talked to him for a good hour in San Diego, and like that dude is just a fucking brilliant dude. And I'm sure you like a Jake as well, but I'm sorry to cut you off, but just like Joey, man, that guy, Joey, props to you, brother.
I find that like Jake and Joey kind of have, they're like opposites in certain ways, and they kind of butt heads in a really healthy way. And then I kind of fit in as a weird like tiebreaker. So sometimes I lean in towards the Joey argument. Sometimes I lean in towards the Jake argument. And that was kind of how we worked for years. Like when I joined, Quay ran on a single like EC2 machine, and like as it scaled up and up and up, like it was just the three of us building out all the products, building out like the service entirely. And whenever there is technical decision, you listen to both sides, and then you kind of wave the flag as the tiebreaker to be like, all right, this side wins. And so that honestly, I think that is like such an effective way to work. Like people talk about, what's it like the pizza team or something like that at Amazon, where it's like, if you can't feed, like a team should be no larger than the like amount of people that you can feed with one pizza. I think really like small teams like that can actually get a lot of cohesion. And if they jive together socially, it can be extremely, extremely healthy. The way that we've worked together as a team is just like proven so well. Like I've seen a bunch of teams now, it's been a couple of years, and I honestly, like, that's my first real like major team out of school that I've spent a long time with. And now that I've looked around, I'm like, oh wow, damn, I got so lucky, like so extremely lucky getting put into that position, because there's tons of unhealthy teams. There's giant teams where nobody gets like any personal attention or growth. There were things that like I was able to teach Jake and Joey, even though they had been in industry for like a decade before me. There's tons of things that they taught me. I kind of just like sponged it all up.
It's almost like you're the quorum, right? You know, and I'm not to use
tech. Exactly.
Yeah. Right. It's like, you know, look, this is the decision. You're the quorum. Like, you know, something that it's like you have this, you know, this great decision tree of three. If you was two of those guys and they didn't have you, right? It's like, where's the tiebreaker, right? So, yeah. Wow, that's just, it's just a great, you know, thing. And you guys, you all have done so much stuff. Again, you know, Quay, Claire, Apps Registry, Operator Framework. I want to talk about the Operator Framework a little bit for CoreOS. Like, sure. I said, I am such an unabashed CoreOS fan. And I told, like, I had Ashesh on, you know, who's the one of the leads for that, you know, and I was like, man, like, you guys stepped in shit when you bought CoreOS. I mean, it's like, this is fantastic. Like, all the things that OpenShift doesn't have, you're able to fill. And I had Zumsky on too. And like, yep. Zumsky, man, that God, it's just like that fucking raw talent, all of those people. And again, just like, Redbeard said, like, all of these folks that at CoreOS have had extended careers at different places because you all set this foundation. You guys are like the fucking Rolling Stones or the Beatles, man. You set this foundation for Kubernetes. Like, Google gets all, you know, respect to Google, respect to Red Hat, but CoreOS, man, you guys were the ones that were writing like things that like no everybody else emulated and everybody else picked up. So I want to props to CoreOS. There's a question.
I totally agree with a lot of that. Like, I worked with Rob, between Rob, myself, Christian Vogel, and then Reza Shafi, we were the only product people at CoreOS. So eventually I transitioned to a product manager. And then when we got acquired at Red Hat, basically Ashesh was my boss. So like, I've worked directly with the people you're talking about. I think the really interesting thing about CoreOS was that we all had a vision. We like knew what the future was. Kubernetes and like everything we built with, and container Linux, for example, Quay, like everything, it was a means to an end. Like everyone was subscribed to the vision that CoreOS had, and we just knew we had to get there. So it was just a matter of building whatever had to be built to get to that point. It could have been a completely different software stack. It wouldn't have mattered. We knew what the vision for the future was supposed to be. We just had to get there. And I think that's like a really compelling thing. And it helped kind of guide everyone at the company working towards that shared vision. So like prior to Kubernetes existing, we worked on a thing called Fleet. And Fleet basically was distributed systemd. So people hate systemd right now, but what if you could just write a systemd unit file and it ran across a group of machines rather than just on a single machine? That's what we had initially tried because we knew what the future was. We were trying to make the gap bridge. But the second basically we heard about Kubernetes, because Google actually reached out to a bunch of companies before they made it public and said like, will you back this thing? Like if we make it public, and you kind of had to commit. So the second basically we were asked about that, like, deprecated Fleet on the spot and started investing in Kubernetes because we knew Borg was basically the thing you needed. You needed a Borg or a Tupperware. Like, you just had to have that thing for the future for containers.
I had Paul Bird on, and Paul, you know, again, was CoreOS and yep. he was talking about Brandon being like Babe Ruth, being able to call the shot and like, you know, be able to say like, this is the technology we should use and stuff like that. And one of the things I'll also say, do you think like, you know, also, you know, Docker, like, be, you know, in the desktop version, like, and not, let me container that for you was just like, hey, it was just a spec. It didn't seem like somebody could just pick it up and go. But do you think Docker popularity also helped the CoreOS and the Kubernetes thing?
Oh, absolutely. El McTuffy, if you've ever heard that pronounced, that's let me containerize that for you. Yeah. That had no adoption. LXC really had no adoption, or like we're targeting a different use case. Like LXC seems to target like machine level images, kind of like you would target a VM versus the application focus. I think honestly, like without Docker, we wouldn't have gotten to that point. But like packaging can look completely different. And you kind of see it now with Co from Google and a couple other projects that are specialized. Like this is how you should package Java jars because they need to be packaged differently in containers. It's not just like start with a Linux base image and add shit. And I think like as we go into the future, you'll see more people doing things like that. But that's actually how, for example, internally at Google, Rapid is the system that they use. And that's like completely packaging differently. Like it they don't necessarily start with a base like Docker style Linux file system and package up their software. They normally try to just make it a binary, but they package all their dependencies together in that system. So like while Docker, like the thing that Docker had was Mindshare. They got people in a place where they could quickly create a container and start seeing the benefits of containers. But there could have been various other ways we could have gotten there. Like I said, CoreOS had the vision. Like if we were going to adopt whatever was there. And at the time, the same thing with Kubernetes. Like Kubernetes wasn't initially all in on Docker. Like it was originally written in Java. And they kind of had to pivot it towards the Docker and Go ecosystem because that's where the traction was. And so like, if you're trying to get from point A to point B and there's a bus going there, you get on the fucking bus, right? Like, so we definitely like invested in Docker. Docker's super critical to it. The place where everybody butt heads with Docker was honestly just because they wanted to own the whole market. They wanted to own everything end to end. And CoreOS already had this long-term vision of like, hey, we're going to own the platform all the way out here. And Docker was kind of like holding everyone back, being like, we've captured the market here. How can we actually make everybody pay? And so there's kind of like this butting of heads where we're trying to move everyone forward and commoditize things as fast as possible to get to the end goal. And they were trying to like kind of slow everybody down and be like, capture the market so that they control everything. But honestly, this is where Brandon stepped in. Brandon is actually the most incredible person at being able to kind of communicate and work with the community. Like if I was going to have like a technical board of oversight, like the bootstrap committee, like the initial bootstrap committee for Kubernetes is the most impressive collection of people, I think, like on the planet. All these people are incredible at working.
You know what's so
companies.
Funny? The only person that I've not had on a show has been Brandon. And Brandon, you keep on avoiding me. I will have you on my show. Sorry.
Brandon's a busy guy. He's a busy guy. He's got
not too busy for the podcast. You know what I mean? You know how much love I have for CoreOS, for God's sakes. Come on, Jimmy.
He literally just had another child, so I'm pretty sure that's why.
I know. I love him and Pulvio. I know it's all good. By the way, what are we drinking, Jimmy? What are we drinking over there, buddy?
This is Hakushu, which is a Japanese single malt.
Awesome. Well, yep. Kazoon type. All right. So moving on. So again, we changed the industry. We did what we did with CoreOS, right? We get acquired by Red Hat. You lived out of a hotel for the first few months of 2018 in San Francisco. Talk to me about that. Which hotel? Was it at least a nice hotel?
It was an awful hotel. all these things happen. CoreOS, like I go out to San Francisco to do like a quarterly product planning. So I'm out there. It's like a couple of weeks for that. I think it's like 2 or 3 weeks for that. So I'm there for that, staying in a hotel in Union Square in San Francisco. One of the shittiest ones. Not gonna name which, but it's not a great one. It's near a pretty good ramen spot, though.
Holiday Inn Express? Let's just call it.
It's not a chain. It's not a chain. But yeah, so like I get back from basically like 3 weeks of that, like being there. I fly back. I'm in New York for like less than a week. And then we announced that like we're being acquired. And then it's like, you have to come back to do basically planning, integration planning. And then it was like another bunch of weeks after that, that I basically went back straight to the same hotel. I remember like after coming home post like acquisition meetings, just being like, holy shit. It was January. It started in January because we got acquired at the end of January. I'm like, I think I spent more time in San Francisco so far this year than in my own house. Like then in New York, like this is where I live. What the hell? So then like later back in May, I was back there for Red Hat Summit, which is where I eventually had met you. It was pretty crazy, going from KubeCon EU directly. So I went from, I was in Boston for a little bit for a Red Hat thing, then back to New York, then went to Copenhagen for KubeCon EU, then went from Copenhagen to San Francisco, and then finally back to New York. And like, my body was just completely destroyed, jet lagged. I had no idea where it was. I also do like, I flew to Copenhagen, like WOW Air, which was Spirit Airlines, like reseller of Spirit Airlines. It was like literally $100 to get from Newark to Copenhagen. It's like the shittiest flight possible.
Was there like chickens on the thing? Did you have like a scrap you had the whole time?
There's not, but the seats are like folding chairs. You're basically like, you get on the plane, it's just like rows of folding chairs, and you're like, you can like move them physically. You're like, if there was something, you'd just go flying everywhere. Like, it's absolutely crazy.
That's insane, man. You were pretty instrumental in terms of the operator framework. Again, I had Zumsky on as well and talked a little bit about this, but I want to talk to you about just, you know, the operator framework and, you know, your work on it.
Sure. So like, yeah, Rob and I were like this when we were working on the operator framework. What basically happened was the origins of it are Tectonic is the CoreOS Kubernetes platform, right? Underneath it, like the whole strategy is auto updates. So we had the auto updating container Linux. Our whole like mindset and like value prop to Tectonic was that it's vanilla Kubernetes, which I've also written a blog post on why calling your product vanilla Kubernetes is bullshit. But it's vanilla Kubernetes plus auto update.
Like we'll have a link in the description, everyone. Yeah. We'll have a link.
So like our whole value prop is around automatically updating the stuff. So how do you automatically update Kubernetes? Well, you take down the control plane and replace it with like new instances of the same like software, right? What does that? And like, how do you do that? Well, the answer is, well, another layer of Kubernetes basically. So you have a controller, like the controller manager is doing all of your software, and you create another controller that knows how to manage the software itself. So we bootstrap Kubernetes as like the first thing, right? That's the first goal. The first goal is have Kubernetes running under Kubernetes. So you can look inside like the Tectonic system namespace or the Kube system namespace and see the controller manager. You can actually see Kubernetes is running on itself. And once you have that, you can do like rolling updates. And now you can actually like orchestrate updating Kubernetes the same way you'd orchestrate updates literally with any other software. So once you have that step, then you write basically custom controllers, which is what everybody's doing now. They're like, woo, operators. What if I like take my app and I write a controller for it? Wouldn't that be cool? Well, we had that idea a super long time ago, and it was so that we could update Kubernetes itself. We saw it as the only way you could actually like update Kubernetes itself because it's so complicated. So that was kind of our strategy. And as we kind of like controllerized so many things, we realized, like, hey, other people are probably going to want to do this. And more of our stuff needs to be delivered in this way. So a lot of our strategy later in CoreOS was about how would you get Amazon-style services on your Kubernetes clusters? Like, how do I give you an RDS? How do I give you something that knows how to run itself? And the only way you can do that is with operators. So we kind of started with two different, like a two-pronged approach. Rob took the angle of like helping developers build operators and making it as easy as possible. So that's the operator SDK. And he largely focused on that. And then I took the route of actually like updating the lifecycle aspects of operators. Like now you have got an operator in your cluster. Who updates the operators? Now we have like yet another meta level of we were updating the clusters. Now you have operators in the clusters. Who updates the operators and how do they know if the operators are healthy or not? So now you have an operator. Basically, it's an operator that manages all your other operators, which is super confusing, but that's what the operator lifecycle manager is. And so this was our way that we could have like streams of updates. You could subscribe to like, hey, give me the stable version of like the Prometheus operator. And so that's what the end result of that would look like on your cluster. It would be saying like, I'm subscribing to the Prometheus operator beta or alpha or stable, right?
If you think about, you know, the beginnings of this discussion that we had, remember we're talking about the whole Facebook thing. And then we talk about this is what you wanted really is what like, you know, Facebook had, you know, has, right? This whole ability to basically have this, I don't want to use the term fleet, but I'm going to use this fleet of machines that are in a cluster that could be on this cloud, could be on a private cloud, maybe a public cloud. And I'm going to click a button. And if I want Prometheus everywhere in the same configuration, to me, the best thing out is to have an operator framework do those things. It's phenomenal. Yeah. Like you said, to have that same thing, if I'm using, like, again, Amazon, it's, you take for granted, you know, I could just click a button and have, you know, MySQL or Percona database up and I'm ready to go, right? Or Mongo, whatever it might be. But like in the Kubernetes world, I have to have my manifest files and I have to blah, 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 you know, and like, well, what if it's running? I have to upgrade it. And then I have to, patch it to, you know, where the data source is and stuff like that. Whereas, man, it's like this framework is, it's open. I can do all of these things. So again, was this something like you all went to go, you know, again, I was a product manager. I know how it is. You go to a couple of customers and like, I'm suffering from this. Did you have any like anecdotal aspects of that we can talk about that was like, shit, I knew we nailed it.
Yeah, it was actually kind of interesting because it was kind of, there are multiple aspects where there's like the Henry Ford thing, where if you ask somebody what they want, they'll tell you a faster horse and not like an actual car. There was that. And then we had a lot of customers that were in that space. We had a lot of customers that were just like already like in the future. They're like, holy shit, they built the thing that we have on our roadmap for like next year. Like they just saw the problem and already had it. And like, then there are people like all in between. And our whole point was, we want to work with the customers that had built custom solutions that were kind of like in outer space and make sure that we could make a generic one that would actually solve that for everybody else. So like there were definitely customers that just like you would walk in the room, you'd start talking to them and they like immediately they got it. Like they got it and they had already built a whole bunch of stuff in line with the same philosophy as you. And it was really a lot of just talking about how to make that real for everybody. And when you get in the room and you talk about that, they're like, hell yeah, I don't want to have to maintain this shit. Like I want something that someone else is going to do for me because I made this thing. It's bespoke. It only works in a small number of scenarios for us specifically. And if like you want to take the burden on owning that and making sure it works for everybody and it's going to work for us in the future, like absolutely we'll pay you for that. So sometimes it's not like if you build it, they will come, but instead like you look at what other people are building internally and you're like, hey, I bet like a bunch of people could use that. And that's kind of like the story of Kubernetes and a whole bunch of things, right? You look at like Borg or Tupperware and you're like, hey, the whole world could actually use that, which is also... the same strategy we have for our new company, but we can get into that later. It definitely is like that. That's the right way to tackle things. I don't even know if that answered the question, but
no, it did. It was good. I liked hearing that. And then, like I said, so you did my segue for me there. All right, yeah. So it was good. So Jimmy, like you're working, you know, still working somewhat with the, you know, your two partners that are in Petrocorp now. Right. And like, and so when did you say, hey, you know what, there's this, we need to do this. This is something we need to do. And talk to me about Petrocorp.
Sure. So Corvus gets acquired immediately. We're in a big company, little did we know it would be way bigger when Red Hat gets acquired by IBM. Right. So it's actually crazy because Jake and Joey were like DevTable, which was their IDE company, then got acquired by CoreOS, then got acquired by Red Hat, then got acquired by IBM. And it's like just like so many acquisitions deep. But effectively what happened was we got acquired and like from the beginning, kind of every, at least across the three of us were like, so how long till we can leave and like start a new company? it really was like a thing where we find freedom in kind of like operating as a small team and working in like that startup environment and like a scrappiness to it. And I had honestly never worked in like a big company before, so I knew nothing else. Just like I came out of college and was like, hey, this is how it's supposed to be because this is how like Tupperware worked at Facebook and this is how Borg works at Google. I like never knew the world of like Chef or config management. I just like went in being like, this is what the world should be. So like my experience is like, I have no idea what a big company is actually like. So I am actually like really glad for the experience of working at Red Hat. It's a great place. And really glad for the experience of like actually having hands-on in the transition from CoreOS to Red Hat. Like that's a once in a lifetime experience. And I learned a ton, but the environment we actually really want to work in is a startup. So like the whole time we're there, we're kind of like spinning, working on our stuff. We really care about like the ecosystem, like maintaining what we've done. And then once we had felt like we had gotten to a place where we could like ethically hand things off That was kind of like how we transitioned and then decided to like leave and start our own company. Now we actually literally didn't have an idea. So this is another like crazy thing, that is really good advice. If we had spent that like couple years while we were at Red Hat, scheming on one particular idea, when we left and actually went to go to execute that idea, if it failed or like it didn't, like our expectations or assumptions didn't meet reality, founders can get into a weird position where they force it to try to work instead of abandoning the idea, seeing it for what it was and saying this actually doesn't have traction and abandoning the idea for something else. So you kind of don't want to be super biased and like tunnel vision on one particular idea. You actually like have to step back and like take feedback from the world. And so like following that philosophy, we were like, why bother having an idea? We'll just leave and figure out our idea after we leave, which is super ballsy. So I spent like the first month, just me and Jake basically sitting in like video calls, talking to each other, being like, hey, what should we do? Here's like a couple ideas. Like, let's talk them through and see where they fall apart. See where they have aspects that are really good. See where they have aspects that are really bad. And we kind of like knocked it down to two ideas. And kind of pitched two different ideas to like close friends and like similar companies. And eventually it became clear that one of them was better than the other. And so we kind of like shelved the other one, just started working on this. And like eventually we pitched that idea to Y Combinator and did Y Combinator interview and got into that, which is really crazy. Basically what the idea is authorization as a service. So the whole pitch is, very similar to what I was saying earlier, at Google or Facebook, you have a team that's dedicated working on just authorization. So authorization is different from authentication, which is the thing that you can actually get as a service right now. So right now, if you went out and you looked at like Auth0 or Ping Federate, these or Okta, these are all services that basically aggregate OAuth providers. So if you want people to be able to log into your application, you slap one of these things on it and then they can log in with Google or Facebook or like GitHub or whatever. But that's where it ends. It says like, this is who this person is versus authorization. Or sorry. Yeah. Authorization basically is who has access to what. So it's the permission system inside your application. So what happened at Google was they started building Google Plus, and Google Plus is a social network. There's lots of, I share a post. They had circles, if you can remember, like where you would share with different groups of people and you could like overlap them and say like share between these two or only the intersection of these two, or like remove this group from the other one. Right. And so like to do that, you need really sophisticated ways of saying who can access a thing and who can't. So they built a dedicated service towards actually like access, like tracking who has access to what. And so literally we've taken inspiration from that and said, you know what, no one outside of Google or Facebook has systems like this. It's kind of like the next step. So the first thing in the cloud is like, hey, let's get our databases, like let's get all these services up. And now it's kind of like the next step up the stack, which is like a service that's actually, it's kind of like bookwork. It's not necessarily the core part of the domain logic in your application, but it's something everyone has to do. Everyone like starts writing their app. They basically have to like model the same thing if it's like an enterprise style app. So if it looks like GitHub where they have organizations and teams and users, you have to build these systems. And then that's a whole bunch of work. None of the open source libraries that you'd find in like Rails or Flask or Django, like really actually even scale to that point. They make it really hard to even do that model. But then the crazy stuff that like the teams at Google will have is they'll have replicas of that literally everywhere in the planet. So like it will be fast no matter where you are, right? But then on top of that, you can actually share once you have your authorization rules in a centralized thing. So if you are, if like the classic example is like I embed a YouTube video in a Google Doc. Like by doing that, if you have access to the Google Doc, you should transitively have access to the YouTube video that's embedded in it. But these are completely separate services. So that means like the permission systems somehow have to know about each other's like nouns. They have to know that like this is a video and this is a Google Doc. And like you have to be able to make that relationship modelable. And there's a problem that basically everyone has that introduces like a second service. So at Quay, we got into all kinds of shit basically by having a super mature authorization system. We basically just used the off-the-shelf libraries in the Flask ecosystem, which is what like pretty much anybody would do right now. You pick that up, and what happened was Docker changed a thing, and we wanted to make that like feature enabled, but it would require us completely refactoring and rewriting all those auth z code. At this time, we had like petabytes of data, like tons of users at this point. And literally, we just couldn't add the feature because we would have to spend so long changing all that stuff. It's all security critical. If you make a mistake in it, that means people can access things they shouldn't be able to access. If you get it security audited, if you're going to actually like deploy it to certain customers, like it just totally breaks down. And then when you have Claire, for example, and like going back to service mesh just makes it so you can identify that like Quay and Claire can talk to each other securely, right? But how does Claire know that it's allowed to access particular images? Like if someone is to hack Claire, they could access all the data in Quay because Claire doesn't act on behalf of a user. It just has free access. And so it's kind of like, and this is basically how everybody builds their services. Like once you add a second service, basically your problem is everyone does mutual TLS, but they don't have any permissions that are shared across them. So it's basically like having two websites, and just because you connected to the website basically with TLS means you can ignore the login box. Like when I go to like Google, I still log in, right? And I still have my user, and then Google can actually control what I'm accessing. It's not just TLS that's securing everything.
Because the back end, they have all those components. There's a central, like you said, there's a centralized thing. So you're trying to bring that centralized piece to the populace pretty much. Is if they have all of these individual, I'm sorry, like I want to boil it down, right? Because at the end of the day, somebody's listening to this and is trying to build this from scratch. Good fucking luck, because it's real tough.
Yeah, it's a really hard problem, right? Yeah. And it's the more services you have, the harder it is. It's really the people that like have multiple services that realize. And what happens is companies look around one day and they hit a make or break kind of scenario. Like Gusto had this semi recently, the payments processor. They basically looked around and went, oh shit, we need this system because we have to share things across multiple services. And they basically had to stop everyone and like, you can't do any product work anymore. You have to build this thing. We have to integrate them all together, and then like product feature work can resume. And like a bunch of people are going to hit this problem. A bunch of people are not going to be able to be confident in changes in their OC code. And it's just one of those things that like, how can you compete with the hyperscalers? This is the whole problem. The cloud is supposed to give you the services that the hyperscalers are using as a competitive advantage. Like that's why it works. And these next level, like next generation services are the ones that don't exist yet. Like there's IAM, for example, from Amazon, but like you can't add your own things into IAM. You can't like teach IAM about things inside of your application. And that's really what we're trying to do, is say like, hey, what if you could extend that model? What if you could teach the centralized permission systems about the things in your applications and then share those? So that's basically the idea.
And there's also an app that's been put out. So sharewith.io is built on this platform. So you can kind of see, you all can see this, and we'll put a link in the description as well of this in action. And the other thing is definitely want to, you all are looking for folks to kind of kick the tires and open up this this platform. So again, in the liner notes, they have an email you can send to be part of this. And, and if anything, these three touch turns to gold. And I wish you the most success with this. This is phenomenal stuff. Is there an open source component or anything so people can contribute, or this is mostly closed source at this point?
So right now everything is closed source. ShareWith is the first app that's built on top of the platform. So we're going to eventually have an open platform where people can use our SDKs and integrate their applications into that platform. And probably simple cases where like you want to do local testing, things like that, will be open source. The idea is to keep basically everything that we have, like everything that we would need to control proprietary, just because we're going to be moving fast and changing a bunch of stuff. But really the advantage you get out of using like an authorization system like this at a global scale is that we're going to run it at a global scale for you, which is really hard, right? That's why there's a dedicated team at Google or Facebook doing this work. So you actually want to pay for the SaaS, and like you don't actually care about that side. But everything that you would possibly care about will be open source. And maybe eventually ShareWith will actually be open sourced as an example application, so that people can actually see, how do I take this SDK and build a real app with it? So that's kind of the long-term goal.
Jesus Christ, Jimmy, man. Gee, I'm like floored that you all are going to do really well with that. Cause I hear that in a lot of discussions I have with customers and end users. I mean, you know, it's just so awesome stuff. So again, good luck with this and all the best, but I got my last question for you. And that's, what work are you most proud of in your career?
So this one is like a really good question for me. I really enjoy this question because there's kind of two aspects to it. I've worked half the time as an engineer, half the time as a product manager. So as an engineer, kind of like the growth and seeing Quay, for example, come from running on, like, at the time we would call it like a cell phone tier, like EC2 instance, but cell phones are now so much more powerful. I can't even say that anymore. But like seeing Quay basically grow from nothing to something that had millions in revenue, like petabytes of data, tons of traffic, like just seeing that from end to end is such a crazy personal accomplishment. And I'm like blessed to work with the people that I've worked with on that. But then also as a product manager, because you're actually like kind of orchestrating and helping people meet like the means to an end, like, and working at CoreOS, it's actually just, it's almost weirdly like the accomplishment of everybody, like the cloud native ecosystem and Kubernetes. I feel like I've had an impact on that and helped guide people in that way. And nowadays I feel like I'm telling mostly people about the past, being like, oh no, hey, we thought of that in like 2015. And like, this was the direction we were taking, and just providing that context to people and kind of like shepherding the direction of the community. I feel like I get credit basically for everything that they've done. And so like, for me, the biggest accomplishment is kind of like the impact on the industry. Like everybody has kind of unanimously adopted cloud in this way. We've kind of turned the adoption of like cloud more away from proprietary services towards more open and sharing like ecosystem. And one that is actually more of the like future that we want to see. So I'm kind of stealing, like, it's kind of a cop-out. Like everybody's work is my work. It's kind of my point. but yeah, it, honestly, like the impact at CoreOS is that like just that legacy of seeing the future and kind of forming it and making sure that we weren't in a world where everybody's using Docker Swarm right now.
Well, Jimmy, thanks so much for all your work, and thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.